Dear colleagues and friends, a warm welcome to the next installment of the Sufi Studies Network online seminars. It's my pleasure to introduce you our speaker today, Dr. Milad Milani from Western Sydney University. Milad needs no introduction, really. He played a leading role in the establishment of this group and the organization of these fruitful monthly seminars since early 2021. During those 2 years, I personally learned a lot from him, not just in terms of scholarship, but also collegiality and professionalism, and a lot as well. I will keep my introduction short to leave more space for Milad's talk and the conversations. The talk is titled Interpreting Sufism and the Philosophy of Heidegger. His talk will be followed by a 5 minutes response and reflection by my colleague at Monash, Dr. Ashkan Bahrani. And afterwards, we will open the floor to all participants for questions, discussions, and feedback. Dear Milad, thank you so much for sharing your exciting research with us. And now the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Aydegan, for that lovely introduction and your kind words. I really appreciate it. Equally, I've learned a great deal from you and benefited from our relationship. Welcome to everyone and thank you for being here. It's truly an honor and pleasure to always see you and share some of my ideas and research as I go along with you. So without further ado, allow me to please start the talk. I have a script which I'll read, and that way time will be a little bit more contained rather than me drifting off into tangents. So forgive that, and please let us get going. So what I will be presenting today is a short form of an argument that will be discussed at length in a manuscript that I'm presently preparing on Sufism and mysticism, exploring that relationship in a more philosophical manner. So I'm going to start with a question, obviously given the title. What reason might we have to seek a new perspective on Sufism? Despite the steady proliferation of books on Sufism since the early 20th century, it remains a tradition that is read predominantly from a single point of view, the Islamic. Few books challenge or discuss alternative readings of Sufism. The debate for Sufism as the mystical element in Islam was won by the argument that Sufism is inborn and homegrown, a debate that was allegedly settled in the 1960s. But this debate is far from over. Sufism is more than Islamic. But what does this mean? And how would this shift the way that we think about Sufism? The question I raise here is essentially an issue arising from disciplinary perspectives and their related methodologies and theories that prop up disciplinary dogma. Specifically, the problem relates to how Sufism is interpreted by religious history, or in this case, directly, Islamic history. The science of history, like any other science understood in the English-speaking world, presents its own challenges of reductionism, rationalism, logicism, and many other isms designed to present a thing in manageable parts that can then be subjected to further analysis and quantification. The kind of science then, in the way that has dominated our understanding of it and in the form that has dictated the basis for knowing for the longest time, is the hard sciences, the mathematical and computational methods of examination that evolved from Cartesian dualism. One figure of repute who challenged the rising norm of the sciences and their technological approaches, its analytical processes and systematic thinking, was Martin Heidegger, born 1889 and died in 1976. He did this initially in his magnum opus, in German, Sein und Zeit, Being and Time, published in 1927. Throughout his career, in particular in his later works, Martin Heidegger advanced what is still one of the most powerful rebuttals of the ascent of machine-like rationalism that today, as he foresaw, is the new metaphysics, the new authority on what is true and real and what demands our submission, if not intellectual praise. Heidegger is most famous for his Destruction, with a K in German, his word for unearthing the truth of the matter, of the millennia-long metaphysical domination over the thinking being's understanding of the world and itself and its relationship to its beingness and the being of beings. Now, I am translating Heidegger's terminology here. The thinking being, or the human being, if you like, Heidegger calls Dasein. The being that is not a thing nor any entity, but is the basis of entities, or simply the beingness of entities, Heidegger calls Das Sein. As with all things in Heidegger's work, his thinking turns on the subtlety of language. And this subtle distinction between Dasein and Das Sein is itself a powerful point of focus and reflection. So let us try and make sense of this Heideggerian jargon, if we may, as we navigate our hypothesis on Sufism. Drawing on the philosophical method of Martin Heidegger offers a new perspective for interpreting Sufism as the mystical in Islam. Looking at Sufism primarily in terms of Heidegger's ontological difference, let us consider an alternative way that we could see Sufism, not as the history of Islamic mysticism, but as the event of the mystical in Islam. For to be able to see it as such, we would need to appreciate something about this phenomenon, Sufism, from the perspective of ontology, as understood in the context of Heidegger's philosophy. Indeed, this way of seeing Sufism challenges the way it is normally seen as a historicized and metaphysical given in the Islamic tradition. Tradition, we might suspect correctly, gives us the appearance of Sufism with which we are familiar. And that aspect of Sufism about which we can say something whereby scholarship might be in general agreement. This is to speak about the what there is of Sufism. Yet at the same time, in the manner that we shall begin to present Sufism, or rather represent Sufism, we might speak about Sufism as in fact divulging a process, or perhaps better, an event that it reveals in its happening. This is to speak about the being of what there is of Sufism. Thus, we are now thrown into the discussion about Sufism in light of Heidegger's explication about the issue of being. We will elaborate on this in just a moment, but to put what we have so far said, in more direct terms, Sufism, defined in terms of Heidegger's notion of the ontological difference, helps us to see two things rather than just one. The what there is as Sufism, as contrasted by the being of what there is as Sufism. On the one hand, we have all that exists as we know of Sufism, in contrast to the very existence of what exists that we call Sufism. I'm using the language of Graham Nicholson from his article, The Ontological Difference, published by the American Philosophical Quarterly. He says, and this will better shed light on Heidegger's meaning, quote, "The ontological difference is the difference between what there is and the being of what there is, the difference between beings and being. On one side, all that exists, on the other, the very existence of what exists." He goes on to say, perhaps the reader has already noticed in reading philosophical texts that the term being or existence sometimes refers to one side of this distinction and sometimes to the other side. It is certainly an ambiguity that has impeded our understanding of the term being. Martin Heidegger coined the term ontological difference to refer to this, in his terminology, the difference between beings and being. My application of Heidegger's philosophy to a degree is to an analysis of Sufism, is simply that if My application of Heidegger's philosophy to an analysis of Sufism is simply that if Sufism exists, it must have a ground of existence, something that we call its being, as opposed to the attributive qualities that might vary between different kinds of Sufism that we encounter and identify. The subject of Sufism and Heidegger might seem at first strange bedfellows. What such a study yields, however, is worth getting past the initial unease. Once in that space, thinking about Sufism with Heidegger presents a natural harmony that is shared in the inexplicable quality of language and the inscrutable nature of being. I should say Heidegger was not a mystic, nor was he associated with a mystical tradition. But Rainer Schumann, 1941 to 1993, had shown in his work a distinctive connection between the philosophical language of Martin Heidegger and the mystical language of the German Catholic theologian and Dominican friar Meister Eckhart, who belonged to the 14th century. For those who are not familiar with Schumann, he was a German philosopher, professor, and director of the Department of Philosophy at the School for Social Research in New York City. He worked on both Heidegger and Meister Eckhart, as well as others, and he's known for the comparative work he did on the shared notion of releasement, or letting be, Gelassenheit, which occurs in Heidegger and Meister Eckhart's thought. And this is where I came across Schumann for the first time. This was done to show the subtle but important connection between Heidegger and Eckhart by way of discussing the link between thought and mysticism. Now, given the scope and limitations of the present talk, we are forced to leave this fascinating aspect of research to one side for now. However, the comparison just pointed out is indeed helpful in supporting the case for the interpretation of Sufism by way of the philosophy of Martin Heidegger, especially if we take certain kinds of Sufis whom we consider to be representing, quote, genuine and great mysticism, end quote, into account. These are Heidegger's words for situating Meister Eckhart. We might also add the proximity of Meister Eckhart's vernacular writings to Muslim mystics with a comparable revelation about being and God, such as we find in Attar's works, as remarkable, lending further support to our approach here defined. In what follows then, our discussion of Sufism will be in terms of the mystical in Islam and our reference to those Sufis that conform to such a reading of Sufism. The approach presented here then is one that seeks to destabilize the idea of Sufism as a homogeneous tradition and its history as one of an inborn mysticism. To be sure, this is a forward-leaning proposition, but one that is not altogether surprising, because the history of Sufism has for long been recycled in the form of a historicization that covers up its inception as a condition of possibility that provided the faithful the next phase in the enrichment of their religious experience. Yet in that very history, I found those Sufis present to us their understanding about this revelation and its possibilities. They disclose it in the hidden form of language through poems or other works of prose. We know there is something different about these works because when we read them, we can see that they are indeed radical to such an extent that their words and ideas shake the very foundation of assumptions about Sufism. Even if we are not always privy, to the full extent of their meaning in the language and through the platform they choose to convey. Such Sufis that have our interest are largely based within the Persianate cultural experience and whose work, either in prose or poetry, reveals the working of poesis, that is, the task of bringing forth into being truth and meaning. Poesis is a related notion to the idea of releasement, Gelassenheit, that I mentioned earlier in Heidegger's philosophy. Releasement is a difficult concept to relate, but it concerns Heidegger's understanding of the happening of truth, as he defined it in terms of unconcealment or aletheia, using the obscure Greek rather than the Latin veritas, in order to underline the difference being that truth is not an absolute abstract fact. It is the revealing or revelation of being. Our choice of the Persianate is therefore not accidental, but indeed intentional. Persianate world is, broadly speaking, the home of the special synthesis that is forged between poesis and hermeneutics. The Persian language remains, not only in our opinion, rich in ancient, deeply grounded meaning from a long and forgotten past. Thus, it is not this language and its culture that is given new life and new meaning by the Islamic, but rather that the Islamic is enriched by the unending yield of its fruits. Persian is significant not because of the chauvinistic argument for an Iranian language in preference over Arabic, because itself it has in its new form many Arabic loanwords, but because Persian is an ancient and evolving language that has absorbed much of the wisdom of ancient civilizations. Persian, like Greek for Heidegger, will be our linguistic portal to ancient wisdom. Language is thus a key component in our inquiry into the history of Sufism, as it is a significant avenue by which we can discern the presence of the mystical in Islam. Thus, we now turn to language and the mystical in Islam. Thinking deeply about Sufism raises questions about the origins of Sufism and its relationship to the tradition that represents it as part of the Islamic world. How did Sufism begin? In whom is its founding experience to be found? These are questions the historian might ask. The philosopher might ask, why Sufism at all? As for the historical line of inquiry, I have already, through the means of a history of ideas approach primarily, identified certain aspects of Sufism's past that can be discussed in terms of a philosophy of Sufism's history. This was the task undertaken in The Nature of Sufism, where the philosophy of Martin Heidegger was utilized to discuss the special case of reading Sufism through an ontological lens as the mystical element in Islam. Because Sufism read historically in this way was not Islamic. The deployment of not Islamic served two purposes linguistically. It was not Islamic in the sense that it did not originate in Islam's beginning, but that it was not also not Islamic in the sense that it was not contained by the limitations of the religious tradition that evolves as Islam, meaning that by virtue of its fulfillment, Sufism, by its very nature, must go through and beyond Islam. The thinking process involved in that book therefore sought to present Sufism as not as Islamic mysticism, but rather as the mystical in Islam. The former defines Sufism as a historically appropriated phenomenon for the Islamic context, whilst the latter looks to Sufism as a phenomenon discoverable within the Islamic context. The phenomenon to which I refer is mysticism. This then leads to our present talk and to our present question, why Sufism at all? The long form of the question, inspired by Heidegger's own question on being and nothing, posed in the essay, What is Metaphysics?, is as follows. Why Sufism at all, rather than just Islam? This might at first be seen to be a peculiar question and an odd approach to the study of Sufism. It is awkward at first because it presents a shift that we are not necessarily ready to hear or even want to hear. This is the shift from historical factual thinking, to which we are so accustomed and with which we are more familiar, toward ontological thinking, the manner already defined in terms of Heidegger's understanding of ontology. Well, Heidegger showed that the ontological approach exposes the covering over of the history of being that is always speaking to us, its truth, through its state of concealedness. So for us, the ontological reading of Sufism is to uncover the forgetting of Sufism as the mystical in Islam. We forget it because it is concealed from us, though it is present in every aspect of its being talked about. This is what, in the writings of later Heidegger, is talked about as the play of being, whereby it withdraws from us whilst always seeking to draw us into itself by way of the calling. But in the work known as The Principle of Ground, Heidegger follows through this play in divulging our role in it, whereby if being plays to us something about the truth of its condition, we must learn to make a return play. To quote John D. Caputo, Heidegger tells us that mortals must learn to play along with the play of being. That means that we must learn to play along with the play of language, to play back what being plays to us. Thus, if being plays to us being and ground, we must learn to make a return play. And there is no better return play, Caputo says, than what Heidegger produces in the text, The Principle of Ground. And in that text, he presents a shift in understanding Leibniz's famous statement, nothing is without ground, or nothing is without reason. And this shift is about how we hear it, from nothing is without ground to nothing is without ground. And Caputo says a linguistic auditory shift of stress here, which allows us to hear something we did not hear before. Heidegger therefore thereby returns the play which language itself is playing to us. Thus, hearing and listening are in Heidegger's later, being the point here, a more mystical styled writing, the language that communicates the significance of reading ontologically, that is, reading in the right key in order to discover the truth of being. We should note, however, Heidegger's message to us is not the same as what comes later in the form of postmodern literary critiques of text that promote multiplicity and plurality of textual understanding based on the notion of relativism of meaning and truth. Meaning and truth are serious matters in Heidegger's thinking, as we can observe in the above quote, which deserves our attention because we are not just dissecting the written word like a corpse, but we are engaging rather with the living thought that lies behind it. And this is the key, and which, if we are listening and can hear, draws us into it. And Heidegger says, to quote, if we may talk here of playing games at all, it is not we who play with words, but the nature of language plays with us, not only in this case, not only now, but long since and always. The language plays with our speech. It likes to let our speech drift away into the more obvious meanings of words. The floundering in commonness is part of the high and dangerous game and gamble in which, by the nature of language, we are the stakes. In following Heidegger's thinking in his later writings, we can find a helpful interlocutor for not only discovering the meaning in Sufi writings that is spoken to us through the ages, but also Sufism itself that is concealed behind the curtain of its tradition. We must forewarn that such an undertaking was not for Heidegger, nor is it now for us, one that is preoccupied with metaphysics or the idea of truth as essence as set in the metaphysical tradition. Follows instead Heidegger's destruction of that tradition, not to abolish it entirely, but to show how we can read it again anew, ontologically. So Heidegger demonstrated this best in his work, Principle of Ground, through his ontological reading of Leibniz's principle, nothing is without reason. Now, Heidegger, how are we doing for time?
We have maybe 10 more minutes, didn't we?
Okay.
It's okay.
Right. So there's a couple more quotes from Heidegger which might be helpful, but I might skip through these for the sake of time. There are things that he says about the birthplace of the ground, the essence of truth, and its ontological discovery. There are things that he says about Leibniz himself as not being simply a characterization of a past system of philosophy, but a name that has a presence behind which we are seeking to understand. And he really plays with that sentence, nothing is without reason, nothing is without ground in that book. So similarly, the most unsettling aspect of our line of inquiry into Sufism, that is through the ways that we have been asking about it, but in the way that Heidegger presents the play of language, is that the ground of Sufism, and this is my assertion here, the ground of Sufism is not Islam. We are then compelled to ask, what then is the ground of Sufism, if not Islam? The resounding answer comes, the ground of Sufism is mysticism. We have asked, what does it mean for Sufism to be talked about as the mystical in Islam? The phrase, the mystical in Islam, places emphasis on in when we read it with our ontological eyes. When it sounds to our ears, then it sounds to our ears as a statement that speaks about Sufism as the mystical that is discoverable in Islam and not just present as Islamic mysticism. How are we to understand the statement, the ground of Sufism is mysticism? So we can now take up our example and explore it with possibilities through a well-known saying among the Sufis of the early period. And this saying is as follows. Sufism was once a reality without a name, and it is now a name without a reality. This quote, which is recorded in several Sufi biographical works, is attributed to an obscure 10th century Sufi by the name of Abul Hasan Abu Shanji. So let us end with the question we posed earlier. Why Sufism at all? The Sufi maxim quoted above has been asking this question, I believe, of us since it was first spoken by the Sufi in question, Abu Shanji. On the surface, it simply states a fact. Sufism was a reality without a name, and now it is a name without a reality. Upon closer reading, we might detect a basic play on words that presents Sufism as a nameless reality and an empty term. It wants to communicate to us something about the fault in our perceiving Sufism. That is, we lose the reality to a label. But let us go further and try and listen to what is being said in the maxim in order to answer our question, why Sufism at all? If Sufism is a reality that has no name, then it is a nameless reality, but still a thing to which we can refer despite what we call it. Abu Shanji's lament is about his observation in his time about the loss of the meaning and what it entails to be Sufi. Still, the maxim speaks to us something more than the lamentation of Dasein, which is only on behalf of the complete, which is only one half of the complete picture of the maxim's existence. Dasein has sensed something is amiss about the truth of the matter, but it has not divulged the situation in its fullness. The maxim is speaking about the manifestation and withdrawal of reality, haqiqat. Haqiqat is an Arabic term and used in Persian that is pregnant with meaning. It means reality, truth, as well as, in certain contexts, God. So it presents the idea about the ground of being on which we stand both intellectually and physically. The meaning of the Arabic, for instance, here retained fortunately for us, makes the detective work a little easier than Heidegger, who had to sift through the evolution of Greek and Latin equivalents into European languages. The Arabic term, therefore, does not suffer the loss of translation in its meaning as the term logos does when it goes from its usage from ancient Greeks before Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle to ratio in Latin when it is passed down into English and European languages in terms of cause and reason, thus separating our instinctive notion for that unity in terms of a bifurcation. And because Heidegger's reading of logos is that it is describing or entailing a drawing together of being as ground. In short, for Heidegger, logos and ratio named together being and ground. And this is an elaborate argument that he presents and walks us through in his book, which I cannot do right now. And following our line of inquiry, then, we can see that what haqiqat presents in the maxim posed by Abu Shanji is what speaks to us even today about the truth of Sufism as related to a reality that has no name. Now, Sufism is not itself this reality, but that its naming suggests or alludes to that reality, which is essentially the point of Abu Shanji's maxim in its basic understanding. Yet we can go further in reading this maxim with ontological eyes and perhaps hear something more about the reality of Sufism beyond its name. On our understanding of the term haqiqat, we can read the maxim as disclosing to us something about the ground of Sufism. But this is not something that we impose on Sufism. Rather, it is something we receive from that source if we are willing to hear it by surrendering ourselves over to its calling. However, in spite of all this, does the maxim tell us anything about the ground of Sufism as Islam? If we read this maxim from the point of view of Dasein in relation to being Dasein, then yes. But if we read this in light of being Dasein speaking to us through language, then no. For Bhushanji, this reality about which he speaks, known to us as Sufism, is defined in terms of the attributes and qualities of Islam. Yet from the point of view of what being discloses to Dasein, we can be certain that there is something more buried in the language than the mere attributes and qualities of the religion that pertain to Dasein in the context of medieval Islam. Not only can we say that Bhushanji had felt something deeply moving in his experience of Sufism as representing that reality about which he speaks, but also that Bhushanji sensed it as beyond Islam, something unspoken that cannot be rationalized or put into words. If so, this must be the ground of Sufism to which he refers as the Haqiqat of Sufism. And what he refers to is the mystical element in Islam, mysticism. The maxim, therefore, is not speaking to us about the ground of Sufism as Islam, but it is rather communicating to us about the ground of Sufism as mysticism, or so my hypothesis goes. How then is Sufism as mysticism different from Sufism as Islamic mysticism, we might ask? The latter dictates the act of closing oneself up from the world and going within. But the former is about the letting go of oneself and letting be of what is. There is thus a subtle shift that has gone almost unnoticed. The concept of traditional and historical mysticism therefore presents the Muslim mystic as religiously grounded. But this turn in seeing mysticism as letting be shows the Muslim mystic as going through and beyond the religion. The Sufism of the Muslim mystic is not contained within the bounds of a religious process, but instead rooted in a happening that flows through and beyond the formal structure of the religion in question. So among the mystics in whom we take interest, there is a long-standing view. Mysticism discloses and brings to light what religion is about rather than religion as talked about, which is to mark a key difference between mystical activity and scholarly commentary. This is then what we alluded to about the forgetfulness of being in Heidegger's thought as comparable to the forgetting of religion as dynamic essence that is covered over by religion as static formality. Concerning the two stages here observed, we must of course first close our eyes and ears to open our inner hearts and eyes, But this first step is followed by a second unspoken stage concealed in the presentation of tradition, which is, in the mystical language of Eckhart, letting God be without our interference. How are we for time? Are we good? I think I should
stop. One more minute?
One more minute. All right, let me just repeat what I said in better. So concerning the two stages here that we've just observed, we do have to obviously in the first instance close our eyes and ears to open our hearts, eyes and ears. But, and here's the catch, the first step is followed by a second unspoken stage concealed in the presentation of tradition, which is, in the mystical language of Meister Eckhart, letting God be without our interference. And the key term here is the word that features in Meister Eckhart and both Heidegger, Gelassenheit. And it's the idea that I'm presenting here as turning, you know, distinction of the different kinds of Sufis and Sufism that we're talking about. So I'll stop there. Okay. Thank you so much for your patience.
Thank you so much, dear Milad, for a very rich presentation that put Sufism into conversation with phenomenology and Heidegger. Yeah, so before we go to the discussion session, which I'm really looking forward to, first, I would like to turn to Dr. Ashkan Bahrani. to hear his initial response and reflections on Milad's presentation. So now I'm giving the microphone to you, dear Ashkan. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Aydo, and thank you so much, Milad. I really enjoyed reading the draft, and now I also enjoyed listening to your rich presentation. Thank you so much for the opportunity. I'm trying my best to be as brief as possible and as succinct as possible. Let me just start up front that today I will address Milad's presentation from the perspective of post-colonial critic of Islamic studies and Sufi studies. First off, I'm intrigued by how you addressed a thorny question in the study of Sufism, Milad. I concur with you that understanding Sufism as Islamic mysticism does not do justice to the phenomenon in question. It's problematic, and I will get into that. Also, I'm fascinated by how you bring the Heideggerian concept of destruction, with K as you mentioned, into the discussion to understand and apply destruction as unearthing the truth of matter, and in this case, to unearth the truth of Sufism sounds quite appealing to me, and I can easily relate to that. Finally, and most significantly, I do agree with you that the Heideggerian concept of ontological difference can open a window, however provisional it can be, to the quest for an all-encompassing criterion to integrate the attributive qualities that might vary between different kinds of Sufism we can identify, to quote you. And understanding the mystical not as the enigmatic, obscure, or foggy, but as Gelassenheit, serenity, or releasement, opens up a possibility to grasp non-ecstatic and more reserved manifestations of Sufi thoughts and practices. In addition to all the insights that your piece grants, your intellectual inquiry made me think of a few questions. How can we read Sufism as non-Islamic without being trapped in essentialist understandings of Islam and Sufism? How do we deal with Islam and Sufism in the study of religion as two refashioned constructs of 18th century and 19th century Orientalist scholarship? Secondly, interpreting Sufism as the mystical in Islam and considering mysticism as the ground of Sufism makes me wonder how we incorporate the long-lasting presence of the ascetical in Sufism. Asceticism, as we all know, is part and parcel of Sufi tradition, even in the most radical examples of Sufism, included in Persian Sufi poetry and prose. Therefore, I find the term Islamic mysticism, as I said earlier, as an inadequate equivalent for Sufism, mainly because it fails to do justice to the ascetical part of Sufism. So I think that we both agree that Islamic mysticism cannot be a fine equivalence for Tasawwuf or Sufism, but I believe that one of the main reasons is it just fails to include the ascetic part of Tasawwuf or Sufi tradition. And my last question deals with the apparently irreplaceable role of the Persian language in this intellectual project. I agree with you that the pre-Islamic intellectual heritage of Persia has been finally integrated into Sufi mysticism. How does this heritage, however, make Persian exceptional or triumphant, if you will? At least since the 12th century, we can say that the pinnacle of radical, mystical, ascetic Persian poetry, we also witness equally radical, mystical poetry in the works in Arabic poetry, in the works of poets such as Ibn al-Arabi and Ibn Farad. I wonder if we consider Persian as the second most widespread lingua franca in pre-modern Islamic societies, shoulder to shoulder with Arabic, as the two languages of mystical radicalness. Thank you so much.
Excellent. Thank you so much, dear Dr. Bahrani, for a wonderful response and a very insightful response. I think your response will start and initiate a very fruitful discussion.